Flashman at the Charge by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 8, Side 1.
"Stand clear, boys and girls," I sang out. "Papa's going to light the blue touch paper and retire immediately." And in that instant, before I touched the match to the firing vent, I had a sudden vivid memory of November the 5th, with the frosty ground and the dark, and little boys chattering and giggling, and the girls covering their ears, and the red eye of the rocket smouldering in the black, and the white fizz of sparks, and the chorus of admiring oohs and ahs, as the rocket burst overhead. And it was something like that now, if you like, except that here the fizzing was like a locomotive funnel belching sparks, filling the go-down with acrid, reeking smoke, while the firing frame shuddered, and then with an almighty whoosh, like an express tearing by, the Congreve went rushing away into the night, clouds of smoke and fire gushing from its tail, and the boys and girls cried, "By Shaitan," and "Istag Farula," and Papa skipped nimbly aside, roaring, "Take that, you sons of bitches!" And we all stood gaping as it soared into the night like a comet, reached the top of its arc, dipped towards the Mikhail, and vanished miles on the wrong side of it. "Bad luck, damn it! Hard lines! Right, you fellas, let's have another!" And laughing heartily, I had another box shoved under the pipe to level it out. We let fly again, but this time the rocket must have been faulty, for it swerved away crazily into the night, weaving to and fro before plunging into the water a bare 300 yards out, with a tremendous hiss and cloud of steam. We tried three more, and all fell short, so we adjusted the range slightly, and the sixth rocket flew straight and true, like a great scarlet lance searching for its target. We watched it pass between the masts of the Mikhail, and howled with disappointment. But now at least we had the range, so I ordered all the pipes loaded, and we touched off the whole battery at once. It was indescribable, and great fun, like a volcano erupting under your feet, and a dense, choking fog filled the go-down. The men clinging to steady the firing frame were almost torn from their feet. The rush of the launching Congreves was deafening, and for a moment we were all staggering about, weeping and coughing in that filthy smoke. It was a full minute before the reek had cleared sufficiently to see how our shots had fared, and then Kutubar was flinging himself into the air and rushing to embrace me.
"Ya la la, wonder of God, look, look yonder, Flashman, look at the blessed sight, is it not glorious? See how they burn!"
And he was right. The Mikhail was hit. There was a red ball of fire clinging to her timbers just below the rail amidships, and even as we watched there was a climbing lick of flame, and over to the right, by some freakish chance, the Ketch had been hit too. There was a fire on her deck, and she was slewing round at anchor. All about me they were dancing and yelling and clapping hands like schoolgirls when popular Penelope has won the sewing prize. All except Ko Daly's daughter, while Kutubara was roaring and I was chanting, "For we are jolly good fellas." She was barking shrill commands at the men on the frame, having them swivel the pipes round for a shot at the Obruchev. "Trust women to interfere," thinks I, and strode over. "Now then, my dear, what's this?" says I, pretty short. "I'll decide when we leave off shooting at our targets, if you don't mind. You there."
"We have hit one, Angliski. It is time for the other."
She rapped it out, and I was aware that her face was strained and her eyes seemed to be searching mine anxiously.
"There is no time to waste. Listen to the firing. In a few moments they will have broken through Jakob's line and be upon us."
You know, I'd been so taken up with our target practice I'd almost forgotten about the fighting that was going on outside. But she was right. It was fiercer than ever and getting closer. And she was probably right about the Mikhail, too. With any luck, that fire aboard her would do the business. "You're a clever girl, Silk One, so you are," says I. "Righto, bonny boys, heave away." And I flung my weight on the frame, chanting yo-ho, while the gleeful niggers dragged up more rockets. They were loving this as much as I was, grinning and yelling and inviting God and each other to admire the havoc we had wrought.
"Aye, now for the steamer," shouts Kutubar. "Hasten, Flashman Bahadur, fling the fire of God upon them, the spawn of Muscovy. Aye, we shall burn you here, and Eblis will consume your souls thereafter, you thieves, you disturbers, you dunghill, sons of whores and shameless women."
It wasn't quite as easy as that. Perhaps we'd been lucky with the Mikhail, but I fired 20 single rockets at the Obruchev and never came near enough to singe her cable. They snaked over her, or flew wide, or hit the water short. until the smoky trails of their passing blended into a fine mist across the bay. The go-down was a scorching inferno of choking smoke in which we shouted and swore hoarsely as we wrestled sticks and canisters into pipes that were so hot we had to douse them with water after every shot. My good humour didn't survive the 20th miss. I raged and swore and kicked the nearest nigger. I was aware, too, that as we laboured, the sounds of battle outside were drawing closer still, and I was in half a mind to leave these infernal rockets that wouldn't fly straight and pitch into the fighting on the beach. It was like hell, outside and in, and to add to my fury, one of the ships in the bay was firing at us now. The pillar of cloud from the godown must have made a perfect target, and the rocket trails had long since advertised to everyone on that beach exactly what was going on. The smack of musket balls on the roof and walls was continuous. Although I didn't know it then, detachments of Russian cavalry had tried three times to drive through the lumbered beach in phalanx to reach the godown and silence us, and Jakob's riders had halted them each time with desperate courage. The ring round our position was contracting all the time as the Kokandian riders fell back. Once a shot from the sea pitched right in front of the godown, showering us with spray. Another howled overhead like a banshee, and a third crashed into the pier alongside us. "Damn you!" I roared, shaking my fist. "Come ashore, you swine, and I'll show you!" I seemed to be seeing everything through a red mist with a terrible consuming rage swelling up inside me. I was swearing incoherently, I know, as we dragged another rocket into the reeking pipe. Half-blinded with smoke and sweat and fury, I touched it off, and this time it seemed to drop just short of the Obruchev. And then, by God, I saw that the ship was moving. They must have got steam up in her at last, and she was veering round slowly, her stern wheel churning as she prepared to draw out from the shore.
"Oh, God, she will escape."
It was Ko Dali's daughter, shrill beside me.
"Quickly, quickly, Angliski, try again with all the rockets. Kutabar, all of you, load them all together before she has gone too far."
"Cowardly rascals," I hollered. "Turn tail, will you? Why don't you stand and fight, you measly hounds? Load them up, you idle bastards, there." And savagely I flung myself among them as they hauled up the five rockets. One of them was still half off its stick, I remember, with a little nigger still wrestling to fix it home, even as the man with the match was touching the fuse. I crammed the burning remnant of my match against a vent, and even as the trail of sparks shot out, the whole godown seemed to stand on end. I felt myself falling. Something hit me a great crack on the head, and my ears were full of cannonading that went on and on, until the pain of it seemed to be bursting my brain before blackness came. I've reckoned since that I must have been unconscious for only a few minutes, but for all I knew when I opened my eyes, it might have been hours. What had happened was that a cannon shot had hit the go-down roof just as the rockets went off, and a falling slat had knocked me endways. When I came to, the first thing I saw was the firing frame in ruins with a beam across it, and I remember thinking, oh, well, no more Guy Fawkes night until next year. Beyond it, through the smoke, I could see the Mikhail burning quite nicely now, but not exploding, which I thought strange. The Ketch was well alight, too, but the Obruchev was underway, with smoke pouring from her funnel and her wheel thrashing great guns. There was a glow near her stern, too, and I found myself wondering, in a confused way, if one of the last salvo had got home. "Serve you right, you Russian scoundrels!" I muttered and tried to pull myself up, but I couldn't. All the strength had gone from my limbs. But the strangest thing was that my head seemed to have floated loose from my shoulders, and I couldn't seem to focus properly on things around me. The great berserk rage that had possessed me only a moment since seemed to have gone, and I felt quite tranquil and dreamy. It wasn't unpleasant, really, for I felt that nothing much mattered, and there was no pain or anxiety, or even inclination to do anything but just lie there, resting body and brain together. And yet I have a pretty clear recollection of what was happening around me, although none of it was important at the time. There were folk crawling about the go-down among the smoke and wreckage, and Kutabar was thundering away blasphemously, and then Ko Dali's daughter was kneeling beside me, trying to raise my head, which was apparently swollen as big as a house. Outside, the fight was raging, and among the shots and yells I could hear the actual clash of steel. It didn't excite me now, though, or even interest me. And then Yakub Beg was there, his helmet gone, one arm limp, with a great bloodied gash near the shoulder and a naked sabre in his good hand. "Strange," thinks I. "You ought to be out on the beach killing Russians. What the deuce are you doing here?" "Away!" he was shouting. "Away! Take to the water!" And he dropped his sabre and took Ko Dali's daughter by the shoulder. "Quickly, Silk One! It is done! They have driven us in! Swim for it, beloved! And Kutabar!
get them into the sea is that there are only moments left.
Kodali's daughter was saying something that I couldn't catch, and Jakob was shaking his head.
Sahib Khan can hold them with his immortals, but only for minutes. Get you gone and take the Englishmen. Do as I tell you, girl. Yes, yes, I will come. Did I not say Sahib Khan is staying?
And you will leave him?
Her voice seemed faint and far away.
I will leave him. Kokan can spare him, but it cannot spare me. He knows it, and so do I. And he seeks his wife and little ones. Now, in God's name, get out quickly.
She didn't hesitate, but rose, and two of the others half-dragged, half-carried me to the mouth of the godown. I was so dazed, I don't think it even crossed my mind that I was in no case to swim. It didn't matter anyway, for some clever lads were cutting loose the lighter that swung under the edge of the godown, and men were tumbling into it. I remember a fierce altercation was going on between Yakub Beg and Kutubar, the latter protesting that he wanted to stay and fight it out with Sahib Khan and the others, and Yakub more or less thrusting him down into the lighter with his sound arm, and then jumping in himself. I was aware that one wall of the godown was burning, and in the glare and the smoke I caught a glimpse of a swirling mass of figures at the doors, and I think I even made out a Cossack, laying about him with a sabre, before someone tumbled down on top of me and knocked me flat on the floor of the lighter. Somehow they must have pulled the thing off, for when I'd recovered my breath and pulled myself up to the low gunwale, we were about 20 yards from the godown and drifting away from the pier, as the eddy from the river mouth, I suppose, caught the lighter and tugged it out to sea. I had only a momentary sight of the interior of the godown, looking for all the world like a mine shaft, with the figures of miners hewing away in it, and then I saw a brilliant light suddenly glowing on its floor, growing in intensity, and then the rush, rush, rush sound of the Congreves as the flames from the burning wall reached them, and I just had sense enough to duck my head below the gunwale before the whole place dissolved in a blinding light, but strangely enough without any great roar of explosion, just the rushing noise of a huge whirlwind. There were screams and oaths from the lighter all around me, but when I raised my head there was just one huge flame where the godown had been, and the pier beside it was burning at its landward end, and the glare was so fierce that beyond there was nothing to be seen. I just lay with my cheek on the thwart, wondering if the eddy would carry us out of range before they started shooting at us, and thinking how calm and pleasant it was to be drifting along here after all the hellish work in the godown. I still wasn't feeling any sense of urgency or anything beyond a detached, dreamy interest, and I can't even say now whether we were fired on or not, for I suddenly became aware that Kodali's daughter was crouched down beside me at the gunwale, staring back, and people were pressed close about us, and I thought, this is a splendid opportunity to squeeze that lovely little rump of hers. There it was, just nicely curved within a foot of me, so I took a handful and kneaded away contentedly, and she never even noticed, or if she did, she didn't mind. But I think she was too preoccupied with the inferno we'd left behind us. So were the others, craning and muttering as we drifted over the dark water. It's queer, but in my memory that drifting and bum-fondling seems to have gone on for the deuce of a long time. I suppose I was immensely preoccupied with it, and a capital thing too. But some other things I remember, the flames of the godown and pier seen at a distance, and a wounded man groaning near me in the press of bodies. Kodali's daughter speaking to Yakub Beg, and Kutubar saying something which involved an oath to do with a camel, and a water skin being pressed against my lips, and the warm, brackish water making me choke and cough. And Yakub Beg saying that the Mikhail was burning to a wreck, but the Obruchev had got away, so our work was only half done. But better half done than not done at all. And Kutubar growling that, by God, it was all very well for those who'd been loafing about on the beach, building sandcastles to talk, but if Jakub and his saunterers had been in the godown where the real business was. And pat on his words, the sun was suddenly in the sky, or so it seemed, for the whole place, the lighter, the sea around, and sky itself, was suddenly as bright as day, and it seemed to me that the lighter was no longer drifting, but racing over the water. And then came the most tremendous thundering crash of sound I've ever heard, reverberating over the sea, making the head sing and shudder with the deafening boom of it, As I tried to put up my hands to my ears to shut out the pain, I heard Kutubar's frantic yell.
The Opera chef, she has gone to the pit of damnation. Now whose work is half done? By God, it is done, it is done, it is done.
1,000 times done, ya, Yakub, is it not done? Now the praise to him and to the foreign professors.
Chapter 12. The last chapter. More than 2,000 Korkandians were killed in the Battle of Fort Rahim, which shows you what a clever lad Buzur Khan was to keep out of it. The rest escaped, some by cutting their way eastward off the beach, some by swimming the Sir Daria mouth, and a favoured few travelling in style by boat and lighter. How many Russians died, no one knows, but Yakub Beg later estimated about 3,000. So it was a good deal bigger than many battles that are household words, but it happened a long way away, and the Russians doubtless tried to forget it, so I suppose only the Korkandians remember it now. It achieved their purpose anyhow, for it destroyed the Russian munition ships and prevented the army march in that year, which saved British India for as long as I have lived, and preserved Korkand's freedom for a few years more, before the Tsar's soldiers came and stamped it flat in the 60s. I imagine the Korkandians thought the respite was worthwhile, and the 2,000 lives well lost. What the 2,000 would say, of course, is another matter. But since they went to fight of their own free will, so far as any soldier ever does, I suppose they would support the majority. Myself, I haven't changed my opinion since I came back to my senses 2 days afterwards, back in the valley in Kizil Kum. I remember nothing of our lighter being hauled from the water by Kati Tora's rescue party, or of the journey back through the desert, for by that time I was in the finest hallucinatory delirium since the first reform bill, and I came out of it gradually and painfully. The terrible thing was that I remember the battle very clearly, and my own incredible behaviour. I knew I'd gone bawling about like a Viking in drink, seeking sorrow and raving heroically in murderous rage. But I couldn't for the life of me understand why. It had been utterly against nature, instinct and judgment. And I knew it hadn't been booze, because I hadn't had any. And anyway, the liquor hasn't been distilled that can make me oblivious of self-preservation. It appalled me, for what security does a right-thinking coward have if he loses his sense of panic? At first I thought my memory of that night's work must be playing me false, but the admiring congratulations I got from Yakub Beg and Kutubar, who called me Ghazi, of all things, soon put paid to that notion. So I must have been temporarily deranged. But why? The obvious explanation, for some reason, never occurred to me, and yet I knew Code Darley's daughter was at the bottom of it somehow. So I sought her out first thing when I'd emerged weak and shaky from my brief convalescence. I was too upset to beat about the bush, and although she played the cool, arch tart at first and pretended not to understand what I was talking about, I went at it so hard that at last she told me. Not to put my mind at rest, you may be sure, but probably because she knew that the only fun to be had from a secret lies in betraying it, especially if it makes someone wriggle.
You remember I spoke to you about the old man of the mountains, of whom you had never heard?
What's he got to do with me rushing about like a lunatic?
He lived many years ago in Persia, beyond the two seas and the salt desert. He was the master of the mad fighting men, the Hashishin, who nerved themselves to murder and die by drinking the hashish drug, what the Indians call bhang. It is prepared in many ways, for many purposes. It can be so concocted that it will drive a man to any lengths of hatred and courage and other passions.
And she said it as calm as a virgin discussing flower arrangement, sitting there gravely cross-legged on a charpai, that's a bed platform, in a corner of her garden with a vile kitten gorging itself on a saucer of milk beside her. I stared at her, astounded.
The Hashishin? You mean... the assassins? Great God, woman, do you mean to say you filled me with an infernal drug that sent me clean balmy?
It was in your kefir,
says she lightly.
Drink, little tiger. There's more if you need it.
But...
I was almost gobbling.
What the devil for?
Because you were afraid. because I knew from the moment I first saw you that fear rules you, and that in the test it will always master you.
The beautiful face was quite impassive, the voice level.
And I could not allow that to happen. If you had proved a coward that night, when all depended on you, we would have been lost. Jacob's enterprise would have failed, and Kokand with it. I would do anything rather than see him fail. So I drugged you. Has it done any harm in the end?
I never heard of such infernal impotence in my life, I stormed. By God, I was angry and resentful and bursting with it. Blast you, I might have got myself killed. She suddenly laughed, showing those pretty teeth.
You are sometimes an honest man, Angliski. Is he not, Puss? And he does wrong to rage and abuse us, for is he not alive? And if he had turned coward, where would he have been?
A sound argument, as I've realized since, but it didn't do much to quieten me just then. I detested her in that moment, as only a coward can when he hears the truth to his face, and I didn't have to look far to see how to vent my spite on her. If I'm honest, it's more than you are. All this fine talk of not failing your precious Jacob Beg, we know how much that's worth. You pretend to be devoted to him, but it doesn't stop you coupling like a bitch in heat with the first chap that comes along. Ha! That shows how much you care for him. She didn't even blush, but smiled down at the kitten and stroked it.
Perhaps it does, eh, Puss? But the Angliski would not be pleased if we said as much. But then...
Stop talking to the blasted cat. Speak plain, can't you?
If it pleases you. Listen, Angliski. I do not mock now, and I do not seek to put shame on you. It is no sin to be fearful, any more than it is a sin to be one-legged or red-haired. All men fear, even Jacob and Kutepar, and all of them. To conquer fear, some need love, and some hate, and some greed, and some even hashish. I understand your anger, but consider, is it not all for the best? You are here, which is what matters most to you, and no one but I knows what fears are in your heart. And that I knew from the beginning. So...
She smiled, and I remember it still as a winning smile, curse her.
Lick up the honey, stranger, and ask no questions.
And that was all I could get from her, but somewhere in it I detected a tiny mite of consolation. I've got my pride in one direction, you know, or had then, so before I left her I asked the question, why did you goad me into making love to you?
Call that a drug, too, if you will. To make certain you ate my kefir.
Just that, eh? Lot of trouble, you Chinese girls go to. She laughed aloud at that and gave a little pout.
And I had never met an Angliski before, you remember. Say, I was curious.
May I ask if your curiosity was satisfied?
Ah, you ask too much, Angliski. That is one tale I tell only to my kitten.
I dare say I've no cause to remember her with much affection, but I do, like the old fool I am. As indeed I do all my girls, now that they're at a safe distance. Perhaps she was right, and I owed it to her that I'd come out with a whole skin. But that was blind luck, and anyway she'd plunged me into the stew in the first place. But it's all by now, and I have only to hold that faded flower scarf that she gave me as a parting gift. And I'm back in the bright garden behind the ranges, looking into those black almond eyes and feeling the sun's warmth and those soft lips against my cheek and... Ay, but she knew too much, the silk one. Kutabar was decidedly right. Still, I had no cause for complaint once I'd recovered from the shock of realizing that I'd fought a do-or-die action by means of a bellyful of some disgusting Oriental potion. I've often wondered since if chaps like Chinese Gordon and Bobs and Custer always went about feeling the way I did that night, not knowing what fear was. It would account for a lot, you know. But God help anyone who's born that way. I'm sorry for 'em. You can't know real peace of mind, I think, unless you've got a windy streak in you.
But I didn't think too long about it just then. The danger was past, all right. I was safe out of the Russians' reach, and among friendly folk who thought I was the best thing to come their way since Tamburlaine. But I'd no wish to linger. When I took stock of what I'd been through in the past year, from the hell of Balaclava and the snow-sodden nightmare of Russia, with its wolves and knouts and barbarous swine like Ignatieff, to the shocking perils of Fort Raim and the go-down, I shudder to this day at the mention of Guy Fawkes. I had only one notion in my head. India and a hero's welcome, no doubt, and after that home, and the sounds of London and Leicestershire, and the comfort of clubs and taverns and English bedclothes and buttered toast, and above all my beautiful blonde Elspeth, who didn't have the wit to converse with kittens and could be relied on not to lace my kidneys and bacon with opium. By God, though, I wondered if Cardigan had been mooching round in my absence, unless he got himself killed with luck. For that matter, was the war over, or what? Decidedly, I must get back to civilization quickly. Yakub Beg was deuced good about it, as well he might have been considering the risks I'd run on his behalf, and after a tremendous feast in the Kizil Kum Valley, at which we celebrated the Russians' confusion and the salvation of Kokand, oh, and India too, we set out for Khiva, where he was moving his folk out of reach of Russian reprisals. From there we went east to Samarkand, where he'd promised to arrange for some Afghan pals of his to convoy me over the mountains and through Afghanistan to Peshawar. I wasn't looking forward much to that part of the journey, but our trip to Samarkand was like a holiday outing. It was clear air and good horses, with Kutubar and Yakub snarling happily at each other, and Ko Dali's daughter, though I never entirely trusted that leery glint in her eye, was as cheerful and friendly as you could wish. I tried to board her at Khiva, but the caravanserai was too crowded, and on the Samarkand road there wasn't the opportunity, which was a pity. I'd have liked another tussle with her, but Yakub Beg was too much with us. He was a strange, mad, mystic, cheery fellow, that one. I don't know how much he knew or what Ko Dali's daughter told him, but for some reason he talked to me a good deal on our journey, about Kokand and whether the British would help him maintain its independence, and his ambitions to found a state of his own, and always his talk would turn to the Silkwan and Kashgar, far over the deserts and mountains, where even the Russians could never reach. The very last words he said to me were on that score. We had passed the night in Samarkand, in the little serai near the market, under the huge turquoise walls of the biggest mosque in the world, and in the morning they rode out with me and my new escort a little way on the southern road. It was thronged with folk, bustling crowds of Uzbeks in their black caps, and big-nosed hillmen with their crafty faces, and veiled women, and long lines of camels with their jingling bells shuffling up the yellow dust, and porters staggering under great bales, and children underfoot, and everywhere the babbling of 20 different languages. Yakub and I were riding ahead, talking, and we stopped at a little river running under the road to water our beasts. "This stream of Siyah," says Yakub, laughing. "Did I say the Ruskis would water their horses in it this autumn? I was wrong, thanks to you, and to my silk girl and Kutubar and the others. They will not come yet to spoil all this." And he gestured round at the crowd streaming by. "Or come at all, if I can help it. And if they do, well, there is still Kashgar and a free place in the hills."
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.